There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave counsel. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile. Glad to have y'all here on this beautiful Friday. Let's not think about what happens tomorrow night. Let's just enjoy today for today and a great show on the way for you. Reminder to get in touch with the show. We make it easy. Good old-fashioned phone call at 343-0106. 343-0106. Same phone number, same number for the text line, 343-0106. And if you have that FM Talk 106.5 app, reminder there, you can run the talkback feature. If you're looking at the front page of the app, which if you don't have it yet, you get a second like today or over the weekend, just look for FMTALK 1065. That's us. Look for that on the App Store for iPhone users or Google Play for Android users. That's our app. Download it. It's free. You stream the station. You get all our social media feeds, our podcast posts there. Get traffic maps, weather information, show schedules, all that good stuff. But on the bottom of the page, you'll see a microphone icon. If you'll press that, you can record a message, emails it to the show, and I can play it back here on the air. And it's a good thing. All right. So keep those handy, those numbers handy, and interact. Maybe today, tomorrow, next week, whenever. All right. Mentioned this at the end of Jeff's show. This is probably the highest level of education that's ever been in the studio at one time, and it's a good thing. I can't believe they let both of these men be in the same place at the same time. You'd think that maybe it'd be like an Air Force One, Air Force Two kind of thing, but it's not. Dr. John Dindo from Dolphin Island Sea Lab and Dr. Sean Powers, University of South Alabama, Dolphin Island Sea Lab, joining me. Thanks for coming in, gentlemen.
Hey, Sean.
Oh, thank you.
Great to be here.
And what brings us together today is a discussion of that. It's weird to say the now late Dr. Bob Shipp passed away.
Yeah, it's strange to think for me that I don't have somebody to show and send a interesting fish to get an identification, to also just talk about, you know, university cooking. Bob and I are both native New Orleanians, so we bonded over that. So it's
we don't
not
hold
only
that
science,
against you.
Yeah, it's food and all those things.
You know, you mentioned the fish ID thing, and I want to talk about, I mean, people know, I think, and listen to me over time, or if they've lived around here, he wrote the book on the fishes of the Gulf of Mexico, literally and figuratively, but his ability to have a fish, and I mean, I'm talking to the two guys who are PhDs here in the fish world. But didn't he have like an extraordinary ability to identify fish that?
Oh, it was absolutely incredible. At the rodeo, he added that most unusual category, mainly because people were bringing him all these unusual things,
deep water stuff and everything.
And he'd be like, "Yeah, that's a so-and-so."
And he knew it. I mean, he just knew it.
What was more impressive is one of these rodeo, and I forget which fish it was. We sent it to him. And he said, "Wow, I've never seen this before. It's blah." I was like, "Well, if you've never seen it before, how do you know what it is?" And it was just amazing. And I could say, we could eventually identify anything.
Sure, and there's a system to that and all that.
There's keys and everything like
that.
But
it's more like a parlor trick he had, yeah. Right? I mean, it's more like a dinner party trick. He could just do it.
But you know, the other thing that he did was, because he was so knowledgeable, he made acquaintances across the country. He would bring down these noted ichthyologists, like from the Natural History Museum in New York, Gareth Nelson, and he would come down year after year after year to the rodeo just to collect bones for identification, only because he had that link with Bob.
Right. And there's, I mean, because I know Dr. Powers and I talked about this before. Sean, you said that there's bones from fish that have been collected at the rodeo that are in
labs and museums. Full articulated skeletons. Yep. You can go to the Natural History Museum of London and ask to see the rodeo collection. You can go to the Smithsonian here, in addition to multiple universities. Yeah. I mean, it's really, really an amazing thing that he brought all of these scientists to Alabama. But it still was, you know, every now and then we would have a fish that we thought, clearly this is going to stump Dr.
Okay, never did. I like this. So y'all are giving me some insight here that y'all said, hey, he won't get this one.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we had one this summer to come in, and it was a little faded out and everything. And so I called right off what it was, and he goes, no, I don't think so. 2 minutes later, absolutely, he was right.
He's right.
And we were arguing over an Alfonso species. And Bob said it was so-and-so. And we're like, no, it's this other one because this one's not reported from the Gulf of Mexico. This one is. And Bob's like, no, it's this one. 3 months later, we send the samples to the geneticist.
That does not lie.
Sure enough.
The final analysis.
Bob was right.
So, I mean, y'all were taking it in context that it's not going to be in this body of water. And he's just telling you, I don't know, but that's what it
right,
is.
Right. It's not supposed to be here.
But that's what it, you know, what's amazing. Y'all two, obviously contemporaries, colleagues, friends with Dr. Shipp. But I've been saying something from my perspective, knowing him over the years. Growing up here, I just thought every place had kind of a Dauphin Island Sea Lab and had a Dr. Bob Shipp and had things like, you know, you just take for granted. You grow up somewhere. This is the way it is. And then to pull back to that 30,000-foot view and realize how rare this combination of things with the University of South Alabama, Dauphin Island Sea Lab, you know, the science that goes on here, this doesn't go on everywhere.
That's correct. That's correct. Bob, you know, Bob was at South, but actually Bob and George Crozier through the Sea Lab, they built the name of the Sea Lab up. I mean, Bob started the marine science program at South and drawing good people in, drawing great people in like Sean Powers. Yeah. I mean, he's here. Bob's the one that recruited Sean for the position here. I mean, that's the kind of person he knew people. He was involved in all kinds of things around the Gulf of Mexico.
The research that goes on here in marine world, are there 50 places like this in the country? Are there 25 places?
Probably a handful on one hand.
One hand.
Yeah.
One hand.
That's what I want people to realize. The thing we take for granted is so special that there's samples, like you said, in international museums. It's known by scientists worldwide, and it's right here at home. And this didn't just happen. It didn't just grow out of the sand on the east end of Dauphin Island. It didn't just grow out of the sand at the University of South Alabama. There are a lot of people that made a lot of sacrifices and efforts to make this happen, Dr. Shipp being one.
Absolutely. And we joke often that a lot of times we feel we're better known nationally and internationally than in South Alabama, the region.
Yeah. It's because we take it for granted, I think.
But I have to remind my new faculty members, because it's easy to recruit them now because we have such a name.
The name.
That there is this legacy that Dr. Shipp and Dr. Crozier had, and it wasn't always like this. I mean, they had to step up. Sometimes they got zeroed out of the budget.
Right.
I mean, they had to.
This diamond in our state, the state didn't have money for that diamond.
Early on. No,
timeline of that, too. Sea Lab started when?
1971 is when they acquired the Air Force Base on the east end of Dauphin Island.
Okay.
The actual program started in, I want to say, probably the mid-60s with the University of Alabama. They had a building down there right next to Fowl River in that area there, and they taught marine science there. Dr. Herb Beauchamp, very famous freshwater ichthyologist, he taught there. He would come down there. Actually, Bob Shipp and Linda Shipp took a class from Beauchamp in that little building years ago.
Do you think that started that link to get him here?
Probably so, yeah.
Wow, I mean, connections.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, there was a time there, especially in the 70s, where, I mean, it was just by sheer will of George and Bob that the Sea Lab survived. I mean, you know, now we just take it for granted, and I take all these things for granted before I learned the history of it. But, you know, it was a lot.
And here's a little tidbit that's pretty interesting. Sean and I both get criticized by Bob and by George because they're both Jesuit trained.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
we're not.
Yeah, you didn't. Yes, that's right. Yeah, if you, if you didn't have the brothers teaching you, you don't know nothing, right?
Yeah, this is the funniest story. Is I've noticed that there's only two cities I've ever been to like this, where in Mobile, New Orleans, when they ask you what school you went to,
mm-hmm.
they don't want to hear Texas A&M from
Nate. They're talking about high school.
School.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So both
yeah.
Bob and George are from New Orleans. I go to the interview with Bob, last step in the job process. I show him all of my accomplishments, all the degrees and papers and everything. And Bob goes, so why didn't you go to Jesuit? The implication being I couldn't get in.
Right, right.
You
were,
and I was
like a smart kid now, but what happened back then?
Exactly. Right. I had a response, but I can't say it on the radio to Bob. And he hired me. So it was pretty good.
It worked out anyway. That's right.
Yeah, if you're just joining us, talking to Dr. John Dindo, Dr. Sean Powers, talking about the legacy of Dr. Bob Shipp, you know, this the times when they get zeroed out in the budget and that force of will in the 70s, we talked about something off air. I think it's interesting. Because one of the things that I celebrate about the legacy of Dr. Shipp and you, John, and you, Sean, is that y'all talk in regular people language, talking Sullivanese, know people around here that are interested in the fish, in the environment, and you don't stay in an ivory tower. But that wasn't always the way with science, right?
I mean, In fact, that's one of the things that we take for granted again today. Agencies and funding agencies now almost require that we go out and interact with what we call the stakeholders, the fishermen and the public and everything. Bob started to do that from the beginning of his career and throughout his career. And not only was it new, he was widely criticized by other scientists for doing that because they really felt that he would be biased if he listened to what the fishermen had to say and listened to their observations. So it wasn't only that he could talk to those folks, it was the fact that he was talking to that. And for probably the first two decades of his career, he did that, and he was criticized because they thought he would be biased if he listened to these other sources of information. So now we know that that's exactly what we need to do.
It's being modeled elsewhere, right?
Well, for example, we had a shrimper come into Bob's office, and I was there. He came in, and his net was all torn up. He says, "You guys ought. Why are we losing all of these nets?" And this is back in the Lower Anzee days, so it took us a while to get out there to figure out where he's losing his nets. And sure enough, it was Southeast Banks, Southwest Rock, and these things were exposed. They weren't exposed before. These guys are dragging over and losing their nets. By listening to these shrimpers, we found all new habitats.
Wow. So, I mean, that interaction probably, just going out on scientific expeditions wouldn't have found that.
We'd have never found it unless we had some, we had to have a place to go to.
And the rock is buried yet again.
Once it'll get covered, uncovered.
Storms. Yeah. That's how much of the burden of sand is moved onto it and off of it.
I'm trying to remember what that did. It was 12.738.
I got it right.
Well, Sean, you're not old enough to remember Loran, are you?
That's when we'd get the Loran on a spot. We'd throw the buoy, then we'd start circle after circle after circle to find it. Coming right back with Dr. Sean Powers, Dr. John Dindo, remembering Dr. Bob Shipp right here on Midday Mobile.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. 12:23 FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile Friday style, and great to have Dr. John Dindo, Dr. Sean Powers in talking about the legacy of Dr. Bob Shipp and talking about those early days and kind of what we take for granted now. But yeah, we had this, a sea change moment, I guess pun intended, or gulf change moment with the oil spill. And we're talking about that as well, when even people that weren't as attached to the water, I think, as so many of us are, started paying attention, right? People said, oh gosh, this thing, even if they didn't use it, there are people, I'm sorry, I'm not coming down on y'all, but you live here and you don't go put your feet in the salt water, I don't get it, but even those people went, holy crap, right. What just happened?
Right. I think that's a good point. Lots of people not paying attention to the coast, not involved in the coast. They don't do the things that you do and the things that we do. But when that oil spill hit and it made world news, the largest spill ever, I mean, that brought people's attention to, this is in my backyard.
Right.
What's going to happen? You know?
Yeah, even if they didn't go to it today, they probably always had this idea, well, I'll get around. I want that there because I want to go enjoy it at some point. And then all of a sudden, people were faced with, you
maybe
might not.
It's not going to, right. Maybe it won't be there. You know, so that was important.
And I don't know if that's, you know, I look at the aftermath of the spill for like municipalities and, you know, what Dauphin Island's done with budget and marketing and all those kind of things. It was a change in people paying attention to what we have here and maybe more even on the marine side as well. Do you think there's people more engaged now post oil spill than before?
I do. I think the money coming into the government agencies, counties, towns, cities, allowed them to do things that they would never have been able to do with their own funding. And that is more environmental, more parks, more parks and recreation, more boat launches, kayak launches, canoe launches. Those things came about, and it would have never happened. I'm not saying oil spill was a good thing.
No, it wasn't a good trade-off, but if you had to get something out of it.
If you had to get something out of it, I think our local community has done really well using those monies.
Oh, yeah, and I think a lot of it is also not only the infusion of the money, but the right people at the right time. And obviously, Commissioner Blankenship, being from the coast as the commissioner, and I'm sure the governor in her calculus realized that we have this money investment. That's probably one of the many reasons she appointed Commissioner Blankenship. But it's having someone like Chris in that position where he knows where to direct those funds because he grew up.
He and I, same age, we grew up run the same roads.
But also the right people is that Chris and the governor and all knew who to call. So the very first scientist they involved in this was Dr. Bob.
Yep.
I mean, you know, they put
him.
So
the spill happens, they get on the phone, they start trying to organize, and they call Dr. Bob.
So their first thing was to put Bob on the Conservation Advisory Board to make sure that you know, the fishes were heard from, so to speak, and that South Alabama, the region, was well recognized. And then the first pot of money that BP gave was a $500 million pot that they had to be forced to give by the administration, by the federal administration. And that was designed to get in there and do the studies right away. So immediately Bob was put on that board to help choose those proposals that were and those initiatives that were most important. And I was talking
related to the
versus having some guy from, not anything against Blount County, but somebody from Blount or Etowah County making those decisions.
Correct. I mean, it was the right thing to do. I mean,
and now we look back at it. Now there's all these funds to do all these things. But remember, BP wasn't giving up any money in the beginning. So we needed that initial pot of money to make sure we understood what was going on, and you know. The first one they called to be on that committee was Bob. And part of that condition, it also shows how you know, ethical Bob was. Part of the condition of being on that board is you couldn't apply for any of that money.
Correct.
You couldn't apply for grant money.
And knowing what was out there, what it could mean for marine science to put yourself in that.
That's a sacrifice. $500 million pot of grant money that, yes, we want your advice. By the way,
You can't
apply for it.
Wow.
Yep. And Bob
knew that.
Bob did it. Bob stepped up and did it. Now, obviously, it benefited a lot of researchers at the university and the C-Lab, but it did not benefit him.
Right, and not like benefit, like putting money in your pocket, but this project you wanted done, you couldn't apply for it.
That's correct.
You could help guide other people to do that. But essentially, in science, you know, our ideas are our currency.
Sure.
That's the other thing.
You want to be associated
Bob
with this piece of research and have your name on it.
Right. Bob gave ideas out freely. There were no currency. He didn't lack ideas. So he wasn't worried if somebody stole his idea or did anything. He had many more in his head. And, you know, that's great that, you know, new Professor X is doing this project. I'm going to move on.
Wasn't jealous of that.
No. And I tell people this, and they really don't. I was talking to Commissioner Blankenship, as well as you before. The thing that got me with Bob the most is, it will surprise your audience, but professors, most of us think highly of ourselves.
Like talk show host.
And have a little bit of ego associated with it. Not Dr. Dindo, but some
everybody
others.
Else.
Bob had absolutely no ego. None. I've never seen it. Now John knew him more personally, and maybe he would come up when they were playing cards or going fishing or cooking together or something like that. But professionally, Bob had no ego.
It's an amazing statement to somebody who had that high of a position. Coming back, more of our conversation with Dr. John Dindo, Dr. Sean Powers, about the late Dr. Bob Shipp.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 12:34, FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Friday. And a great conversation. Like I said, the highest level of education ever in the studio at one time. Dr. John Dindo and Dr. Sean Powers in, and we're talking about the legacy of Dr. Bob Shipp. And, you know, we can go read the obit, we can go read the news stories and see the superlatives like we've talked about. But what we've gotten into with y'all is what goes on behind the scenes. You get the superlatives of, you know, the books, the work to make the C-Lab happy. Those things can be listed, but how? You know, in the 70s, the tough days. Him taking, you know, taking one for the team and getting on the Conservation Advisory Board, even though he couldn't, you know, then have projects. These are the things we don't know. And I think the more things we know about the person behind the image of Dr. Shipp is important. That's why I think it's important when John said, hey, you know, he and I not only cooked together, we took a cooking class together. So here it is. I'm picturing Dr. John Dindo, Dr. Bob Shipp in a cooking class. Is it all kind of food or specific food?
No, we put on the class.
We put the class on.
Okay.
So
is science not enough for y'all? Was it not enough?
No, it was.
You have
science.
To dominate everything.
It's the science of cooking seafood. That's
okay.
That was our whole basis.
Okay.
Was
okay.
It? And
it was all pompano.
So that's right. So we set this thing up. It was a place called Marché de Gourmet, and it was a big gourmet store, and they had a kitchen with all the mirrors and everything. So they asked Bob and I to put on about a month's worth of cooking shows, you know, once a week.
Okay.
So we do that. And well, the second time our wives decided to come down. Linda and Charlene came down to the cooking show, and they sat in the back. And of course, you know, and you get a good cooking show going, wine has to be spread around.
Yes.
So wine was being spread around, and Bob and I are up front, and we're cutting this and cutting that, and we notice the bottles are going back to the back more often. And then all of a sudden, we're turning some fish over in one platter, and I'm doing some squid over here, and somewhere in the background, somebody's yelling, well, Bob's cut his finger. And there's big mirrors up, and sure enough, Bob had cut his finger. He didn't see it, but everybody in the audience.
I don't want that dish. Whatever he's got right there, I don't want that dish.
But, you know, Bob's son is a chef.
Yeah.
Matt Shipp is a great chef.
Pretty famous.
But Bob is a great chef. He cooked all the time, and he was really, really good at it. His son, Matt, we used to get together for years and years. Matt was 10 years old, and George and Deanna and Charlene and I and Bob and Linda. And Matt comes out and he bakes a whole bread, 10 years old, and brings it out to us for our dinner, part of our dinner.
That was at 10.
At 10 years old.
My 13-year-old and I are working on grilled cheese this weekend, so he's not at the advanced level. Grilled cheese is our challenge.
I'll say one other thing about Bob. There was a National Geographic Explorer years ago, and I watched him, and he had just found some of this phenomenal thing, and he said, somebody asked him, well, this is a great discovery. And he goes, you know, I can only do this because I'm standing on the shoulders of giants.
Wow.
And that's how I feel. I feel that I've been around some phenomenal giants in my life that have just given me direction and the reason to be out there.
Yeah, and we all benefit by this happening right here. I know the nation benefits from the research done, but number one, y'all are homeboys. You're here. Dolphin Island Sea Lab is not United States Sea Lab. and that's the benefit right. to the Gulf and the northern Gulf of Mexico. I want to talk about that, too, in the broader scope. Something I know that Sean and I have talked about, and I know you're very involved with, and you and I have emailed about. I'm a kid who grew up in the Mobile Tensaw Delta. I mean, that was my playground. I was dropped off, you know, with a boat and, you know, 14-foot Richline with a 1968 20-horsepower Mercury.
Wow.
And that's kind of how I was, you know, they free-range me out there. I've seen a lot of changes, I think, in the Delta since the 1980s, but I also realize the scope of time that, you know, human beings, we have this egoistic idea of how things should be because they were that way 10 years ago, and we're dealing with cycles that are 1,000 or 20,000 years or whatever. But more research, more interest being brought to the Mobile Tensaw Delta now. I applaud that.
As it should. I mean, it is. I wish I had that same opportunity. I grew up in Vermont, so, yeah. I mean, that's a long ways away from the Mobile Tensaw Delta. Yeah. But, I mean, I've spent a lot of time up there. Wonderful relationship with Dr. E.O. Wilson. Spent time with him up in the Delta.
You talk about the shoulders of giants we're all standing on. Wow.
Learning more and more stuff, and it's been great. And I've seen change, just like you. Early on up in the Delta when the paper companies were there, mm-hmm. I mean, big swaths of the Delta just cut right to the water's edge and stuff.
Yeah, no SMZs.
If you fly it today... If you look at it and fly it today, those places are all grown back in. Mm-hmm. And one of the greatest things that's happened is the Forever Wild.
Yeah.
Forever Wild come in and 138,000 acres of bottomland hardwood.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Part of the gift to everybody in Alabama.
And we're going to hopefully buy more. We were at the Forever Wild Board on Thursday.
Yeah.
And we try to prioritize areas like the Delta just because we know how important it is. And it's an amazing, amazing program. I mean, to hear the commissioner talk about it, hear what they're doing is they're taking some of the interest off the oil and gas revenues.
Go make some money.
Yeah. Yep. No. So this is how the Forever Wild is
the original
funded.
Funding, not right. additional.
Yeah.
Funding.
Yeah. So and taking money from a resource that's very finite,
mm-hmm.
oil and gas, and then they're making it a permanent thing mm-hmm. with those funding right. by acquiring that
right.
that land. And that's just a tremendous program. I don't know of many states that have a program like that. So.
And remember, Sean, it was a 20-year program.
Mm-hmm.
And when the 20th year was running
re-authorized,
out, all of a sudden they said, oh, you know, we don't know if people want to do this anymore. And
guess
overwhelming
what?
Overwhelming state support from
absolutely.
The north to the south.
Yeah, absolutely. People stood up for it, even though there was special interest. And, you know, I got called some names by, you know, folks said, well, I thought you were, you know, conservative guys.
But it's interesting.
This program.
John is also being very modest. So for a long time, John was the only scientist working in the Delta. And obviously his focus was a lot on birds, but it was a lot on the vegetation. And that now, you know, we've hired a couple of new scientists who are just going to focus on the Delta. So hopefully that part. But you joke about being, you know, I get scared about being left alone in a Delta. I still.
Man, it's at home. It's a living room for me.
I mean, I got to be with John or Ben Raines or somebody, or I'm going to wind up sleeping on one of those grass flats.
Which is not a bad thing anyway.
It's not a bad thing. But
I don't know. In August, I don't have enough mosquito repellent to
Well, there's
sleep
so much technology
there.
Now to keep you maybe out of some of the trouble. But, you know, I guide people who come down for gator hunts here. I take people, you know, from elsewhere, and they go, why did you turn the boat there? Why did you run so far from the shore there, so close there? I said, because when I was 13, I got stuck real bad there. When I was 15, we blew the skeg off the boat there. Yep. You know, it all came from hard knocks.
Plus, it's constantly changing.
Constantly changing.
It is.
Constantly. There's some things, some channels kind of stay the same, some meander.
Right.
Yeah, you have to adjust each year. But with the Delta, and that, you know, I don't know the land y'all were talking about buying. I know conversations I've had with Ben Raines as well. The uplands that lead into the bottomlands and their importance of that interface zone, you know, what that means to the Delta, mm-hmm. not just the bottomlands. But what questions are we looking at now? John, what are you looking at? What are the new scientists working on? What I see each year people say, hey, it looks like the water flow is higher, you know, in the summertime than it was in the past, at least on the east side, you know, Blakely River and all that. Are there questions like that being asked?
But see, you made a good point early on, though. We look at it in our time frame.
Right.
You know,
human beings are...
80 year, 90, you know, that's the time frame that we want to look at, because that's where we are. We're up in there looking at, in reality, those are just minor little blimps, these changes that you see there.
Right.
So, I mean, we're looking at, when go up in there, look at where the bird colonies are. Keith Galden was one of the very first game officers up in the Delta when the Delta
became. Shout out to Keith. I was with him over the weekend.
Yeah. Well, he's a great guy, and he and I, we went back way back into the backwaters of the Delta, walking through swamp, waist deep, to find a bird colony that was an isolated bird colony. It was the only one there, yellow-crowned night herons, and they only nested in this one spot. And below them, there's quite a few water moccasins waiting for a chick to fall out of the nest.
Sure.
I mean, it was just that's the kind of stuff that's just amazing.
It is, and I think this renewed interest too that I've seen over maybe a couple decades, but for sure the last decade, the way we talked about the oil spill, getting people more oriented towards the full marine environment, but the Delta, people appreciating, is once again, it's just where I grew up. And so I thought, well, everybody's got one of these.
Everybody's got the richest biological diversity in their backyard.
They got a place they can just go up and net up some grass shrimp and go catch some brim and then come back down to Max on the causeway and get a hamburger. I thought that was normal.
And we have scientists that are still looking at that diversity, the birds and the fish and everything. But the bigger things is what does that delta mean for the bay? We've talked to people who said the turbidity is high in the bay, and we know it's relatively high because we don't have as much seagrass as we had. So what does the delta do to decrease the turbidity of the water entering the bay and help with seagrass?
I'll be better off in that, though, because I look at it, the turbidity is obviously an issue. But as you go upstate, like John said, I mean, we now have SMZs. I mean, I believe in cutting trees. I'm a person who cuts trees, but you leave streamside management zones. You do silt fences. You do these things.
Streamside management.
Yeah. Right. You do these things to keep this runoff from coming all at one time into a waterway. So I think it's gotten better, but has it?
One of the things is we don't have long-term data.
Yeah, do we have a baseline? What's the baseline?
No, we don't. Not on things like turbidity. We have some data here and there. I mean, and, we don't have a whole lot of data on the extent of seagrass beds in the bay. So seagrass require a certain amount of light.
Light.
And so
is this that old photosynthesis thing?
Yeah. I can give you the equation if you worry. But anyway, sorry to geek out there on you.
It's all right. I like it.
But, we don't know how much seagrass there was. We know there's seagrass. Folks that we talk to say the bay is more turbid, even though they're very knowledgeable and recognize estuaries are always turbid.
Sure.
But there's a critical level. So we have some really smart guys working on with supercomputers to model, now what happened when we put the ship channel in. What happened when the causeway went?
What
happened when this? So I think there was something major in the sometimes between the 60s and 70s, maybe post-causeway. Right. And the causeway definitely altered a lot of things that happened. Something major that happened.
And don't, but go back and take a look. Think of history of the bay, Mobile Bay. Think about how sailboats couldn't go up the bay.
That's right.
Why? Because they were littered with sandbars from east to west side.
The pilots, right? You had the pilots who were down at Navy Cove and that end, and then they would meet for the upper bay pilots to get them, offloaded or get into the Mobile River. Yeah, you had two sets of pilots because of that.
Right. There was a lighting station at Dog River.
Yeah.
Heavier boats had to lighten their load to go further north.
So things have changed.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff for us to learn. But, I mean, the main thing is for your listeners to know we do have this incredible resource, and many recognize it, many don't. Just phenomenal.
Right. I think we're doing the right thing here and getting more people engaged. We're going to come back from the break. As I go to break, though, this text here, this one from unnamed texter, but it said, I like this. Dr. Ship had taxonomic swagger. If someone came to the rodeo weigh-in and tried to pass off a juvenile king mackerel as a Spanish mackerel, he would lift up the dorsal fin, look at the lateral line, and educate the angler on the difference.
Sounds like a personal experience to me.
But taxonomic swagger.
I've never heard about that, but it's probably the most common thing we have, people bringing in these juvenile kings and thinking they got the record Spanish mackerel.
We could only wish you had a Spanish that big. Coming right back, more Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 Midday Mobile, and great to have Dr. John Dindo, Dr. Sean Powers in studio talking all things Marine and also the legacy of Dr. Bob Shipp, which, speaking of which, we did this earlier in the week. Let's do this again. Looking for caller number six right now at 343-0106, 343-0106, a copy of Dr. Bob Shipp's Guide to the Fishes of the Gulf of Mexico. And caller number six, the book is yours. You know, Dr. Dindo, that's one of those things. I think I said it to Blakely Ellis from CCA earlier in the week. When I walk into somebody's house and they have this, I go, okay, they're my kind of people. Like,
he's on your side. You know him right away.
Right, they're my kind of people.
Exactly.
So it really is a special, special book. And I mean, it should be part of the accoutrement of any house here in Mobile and Baldwin County.
Absolutely. Well, really, across the Gulf.
Across the Gulf.
Fishers
for sure.
Across the Gulf. They need this book. And
it is so cool. And the artwork in it is fantastic. And there's some photos that are of note here we might talk about in the future.
Yes. The other thing, too, is to realize that book is written for fishermen.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we have other taxonomic guides and everything we use to identify fish with all the nitpicky, but Bob wrote that
identification specifically for
fishermen. And so it has very interesting, it summarizes the life history, the habitats of that. And that was the most impressive thing. Your texter identified one of the things Bob did, but a lot of times they would come in with an interesting fish or whatever, and Bob would not only ID it, Bob would tell the whole life history of this fish to this fisherman, and it was just amazing. All of a sudden, he was talking to one fisherman. Then there's about, 16 students around him, 16 other fishermen.
Yes.
All listening to this story about how this fish lives, and
was my experience. I was one of those 16 fishermen. Yeah. I would listen to it when he would, when he would, the old E.F. Hutton moment, when he would, when he talked, we listened.
I judged with him for 15 years before I took over as head judge when he retired. And the joy in a fisherman's eyes when Bob remembered his name.
I mean,
you could really see. And you were there, I think, last year when he came. I mean, one of the rodeo guys joked, you would have thought Mick Jagger was walking.
That's right.
I mean, the amount of people that were around him wanted to get a picture with him. And so many people throughout the years, when their son or daughter caught their first fish, and it's the case with me, they wanted that picture with Dr. Bob.
Of course.
Right. I mean,
That's wall material.
I mean, and that tells you, I don't know any other professor who's ever had that level.
It's rock star stuff.
Nobody wants that picture with me.
We're going to change that, Sean. I'm going to read through a bunch of texts in here. I'm going to pick a few of them. The Mariner said, Forever Wild is the best program the state of Alabama has ever implemented. This texter, the unnamed texter here said, love and respect to Dr. McPherson at the Sea Lab 2. He passed away a couple years ago. He was there for years as a patient of ours at USCG Brooklyn Base. So, and also, Jerry says, I wish we could save our bay. This is interesting. This is probably going to be something for another conversation because I don't think we can get it done in minutes, but I wish they could save our bay from the ship channel. Is discussion we can get in, the question about the ship channel and the sewage, which is everybody knows is my high horse. I ride all the time. And he said it will take a giant to stand up and do the right thing.
So I would say on the widening and deepening of the ship channel, yes, that's a whole nother talk, and we could talk about all those trade-offs and those things. Now, sewage
is a big deal for business here too.
As you know, sewage is one thing the state has made incredible strides on. A lot of the funding from GOMESA, the Energy Security Act, the oil spill have been directed right at those water quality issues.
$60 million has been given out,
It's an incredible amount.
Because when Director Blankenship was on, but the one thing that he did say that it stuck with me is there are agencies that have not applied for it, that money.
Community agencies?
And also utilities that could use this that have not applied for it. And that part, the state's doing the right thing, but hey, utilities, if you're leaking sewage, there's money for you. I don't know how y'all don't know.
I hope all these municipalities, there is literally wheelbarrows of money coming with the Biden infrastructure money and bipartisan infrastructure, right, whatever they call it. And regardless of what your politics are, you should take that money
and
clean up our water, because they're going to spend it anyway. So you might as well spend it doing exactly what we want done.
Yeah, I look at it this way. Like, if you had – the reason we're here to talk about, you know, Wilson's book even, right, why we're here, is the water. This is why we're here, is the water. If you have Disney World, you don't let Disney World get run down, because that's why people come to that place. It should be, to me, it's nonpartisan.
Correct.
This discussion of keeping our water clean, and to have, you know, it rains a quarter inch and then we have shutdowns of you can't fish, can't get in the water. Yep. It's unacceptable to me. And if there's money out there to do it, let's do it, damn it.
Not these days when we have the technology.
That's the thing. I was just going to say the technology. I mean, you know, what do you think's going on in those space shuttles and are up in the, you know, I mean, come on.
They're dealing with it somehow. Right.
Exactly.
So, and it, maybe it's just more of us. And I think over the, you know, decade and a half here, I've been doing this show on the station. I think I've changed the hearts and minds, and I'm going to keep doing it because I think it should be, I know it doesn't have a big groundbreaking or ribbon cutting like other things do. It's not as sexy. But to me, having our water clean and the kids can swim at any time is sexy.
No, and you know? I love it that it's a priority because, you know, to be honest, you know, I mean, people just take water quality
for granted.
Yep. Yep. I mean, we want more fish. And we
still
want
look around the world,
something.
The places that they have not paid any attention to it, where you can't even get in the water, the fish are inedible, or they die. Yeah.
Right.
But no, I think it's the exact right move, what the state's doing. I mean, that get the water quality, let's improve it. And the amount of money, like you said, I don't know about all municipalities taking advantage, but you know they're going to make a significant impact on increasing the water
and for the future.
And largely it's money. A lot of the money is from the biggest disaster we've ever known, right. The oil spill, and something good.
Let's have something good. Let's have something that's long term good.
Yep.
Dr. Dindo, Dr. Powers, thank you. Gentlemen, for being
here.
Thank you.
You ever come back and see me soon?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk all this stuff and talk Delta a whole bunch. I have so much to talk about with the Mobile Tensol Delta. So y'all are a font of information. Reminder, too, it's that jewel that's right here in our backyard. I know we grew up with it, but Dolphin Island Sea Lab, whether you go to the estuarium or take part in the programs with it, this thing that is internationally known is right here in our backyard. And there was a lot of work done to make sure that happened. So we should enjoy and appreciate it. Hour number two of Midday Mobile on the way in just minutes. News is next.